Okay, we're beginning here on the second wide line at the bottom of Kuf Bet Amud Bet. Tan Rabbanan, Halokeach Sadeh B'Shem Chaveiro, person who purchases a field in his friend's name, Ein Kofino told him Kor, we don't oblige him to sell it back to him. V'mamar lo al menat, if he does it on that condition, Kofino told him Kor, then we do press him or obligate him to sell it back. This is a breita that we're bringing down. It's obviously somewhat cryptic, and that's what the Gemara says, Maika Amar. What exactly is meant by this breita? Amar of Sheshet, Hachi Kamar. This is what's meant by the breita. Halokeach Sadeh Mechaveiro B'Shem Resh Galuta. A person purchases on behalf of himself a piece of land, but instead of writing it in his name, he has the seller write it as if he's buying it for the exilarch, the Resh Galuta. Ein kofino to Resh Galuta limkor. We don't force the exilarch to sell it back to the individual who actually laid out the money. So here, he goes in and pays for the field. Instead of having the contract written in his name, he has the contract written in the name of the Resh Galuta. So, in essence, he is doing a favor for the Resh Galuta and buying the field on behalf of the Resh Galuta. His true intent is to have the Resh Galuta then sign the field over to him. But we do not obligate the Resh Galuta. The Resh Galuta or the exilarch had nothing to do with this transaction, and we're not going to compel him to sell it back. V'yamamar al-minat, on the other hand, if he made the condition of the sale, then kofinet Resh Galuta limkor. We do compel the Resh Galuta to sell it back to him. As Rashi notes over here, the reason that he does this is in order to protect or basically buy title insurance on the land that he's buying. He knows that if it goes through the hands of the Resh Galuta, then nobody's going to come and be me'arer and question the validity of the ownership of the land, because the Resh Galuta is seen as the highest sitting authority, and nobody's going to question the authority of the Resh Galuta. So therefore, if he basically passes it through the hands of the Resh Galuta, then he has, quote-unquote, laundered the property through the Resh Galuta and prevented anyone from making a claim against him. So what he wants to do is purchase it in the name of the Resh Galuta, and then have the Resh Galuta, the exilarch, write the property or sell the property over to him. So now the way that Rav Sheshet explains the Braita is that in a case where he simply does it without disclosing any information or placing any conditions, we do not compel the Resh Galuta to do anything. On the other hand, if he made that the condition of the sale, we do compel the Resh Galuta, the exilarch, to sell it back to him. So Amar Mar. So again, now we're going to investigate. Amar Mar, Lokeach Sadeh B'Shem Resh Galuta, Ein Kofino To Resh Galuta Limkor, Michlau, Demitne Kanyule. It sounds like that he really bought it. So now, it sounds like that he really does own the property. We just don't compel the exilarch to write it or sign it over to him. Lema pliga de b'nei marova. Sounds like he's arguing on the b'nei marova that we saw in yesterday's daf. De amre v'chi mi hodio de bal chitim, shikne chitim de bal abayit. Because there they said, who identified to the seller that he's actually selling it to this individual? Also over here, the seller, as far as he's concerned, thinks he's selling it to the Resh Galuta. This person indicates that he's a proxy for the Resh Galuta. He's a shliach, he's acting on behalf of the Resh Galuta, and buying it and wants the contract to the name of the Resh Galuta. As far as the seller's concerned, he sold it to the Resh Galuta. All of a sudden, this guy goes and wants now the Resh Galuta to sign him over to him. So we don't compel the Resh Galuta to do it. But, in essence, he has bought the property for himself. Well, how did he buy the property for himself? There was no acquisition here on behalf of himself, and the seller never made a kinyan that granted it towards him. So that sounds like it argues on what the B'nai Marava say, that even though there was no identifying fact in the case that he was buying it, nevertheless, he does take possession of it. It says, Ishum ha lo kasho. That's not really a question, because going to Ode the Balasadeh, Odinu the Sadeh, he made it clear to the owner of the field, and he made it clear to the Edim that he is buying it on behalf of himself, but he wants the contract to be contracted to the Resh Galuta. And then he tells him, I'm going to go to the Resh Galuta and have it signed over to me. So the seller knows that he's really selling it to this guy. He's just writing the contract in the name of the Resh Galuta. Tosafot in the next Amud ask, if that's the case, why doesn't he just get the Edim to write him a new contract? Because the Edim are witness to this whole event. They could actually draw up a contract that gives evidence to the fact that he really owns the field. So Tosfot says it's a case where the Edim are not interested in getting involved or writing a new contract, so he needs the Resh Galuta to sign it over to him. Ela Ema Seifa. So now the Gemara says, okay, we dealt with the first half of that bright, the way Rav Sheshet explains it. Let's look at the latter half. Amanat Kofino To Resh Galuta Limkor. If he says it's on condition that the Reish Galuta signs it over to me, then we compel the Reish Galuta, the Exilarch, to sell it to him. Amai, why do we force the Reish Galuta? The Exilarch can say, I have nothing to do with this. Velema Reish Galuta, the Reish Galuta can say, Lo Yakrai Chubina, Velo Zilutai Chubina. I don't want your honor, and I don't want your depreciation. Or in essence, what he says is, you honored me with this selling of the land to me because you know that I'm above reproach, but then you're now making me into a small-time business person having to write contracts to you and sign over property to you. I'm not interested in the honor. I'm also not interested in selling you or becoming a broker for properties. And so therefore he says, I don't want anything to do with this. How can you compel the Reish Galuta without any acquiescence to be involved in the transaction and to sign it over? So that doesn't make any sense. Ela Amar Abaye, so Abaye gives an alternate explanation of the Braita and says, Hachikamar, this is what's meant by the Braita. Halokeach Sadeh B'Shem Chabero Reish Galuta. Over here, where the Reish Galuta, Rashi has the Girsa in. You see here the Rosh takes it out. It might be implicit in the statement anyway. That's why it's unnecessary. But in the end, he buys it in the name of the Reish Galuta. Ein kufinat amocher limkor zimna achrite. We do not compel the seller to write him a second contract in his name. Basically, what he wants is two contracts written for the sale. He wants one contract that's written in the name of the Reish Galuta, and he has another contract that's written in his own name. Therefore, if anybody comes to question the ownership of the field, then he pulls out the contract that says it belongs to the Reish Galuta, belongs to the Exilarch. Take it up with the Exilarch. It's not my issue. You can't question my authority or my being on the field. So that will be his title insurance, in essence. Then he has a second contract, which has the field written in his own name. Therefore, if the Yorshim of the Reish Galuta show up and say, well, the field belongs to the Reish Galuta, it belongs to us now, he can take out the contract and say, no, I own the field. So he really wants two contracts written here, and he can pull out each one in the different scenarios in order to protect himself. But he only had the seller at the time of the sale write one contract, and that was to the Reish Galuta. We do not compel the mocher, we don't compel the seller then to write a second contract in the name of the buyer. Now here it's clear that the buyer is the buyer of the property because all of that information is disclosed. He's simply writing the contract in the name of Reish Galuta because of the protection that it affords. So the seller knows he's selling it to this individual. He just asked for one contract to be written in the Reish Galuta. He says, fine, I'll do that for you. But then he comes back and says, I want another contract. We don't compel the mocher to do that. The mocher says, I don't want so many contracts with my name out there. On the other hand, in Amar Lo Almanat, if he did it on condition, meaning that he says the condition of the sale is that you provide me with these two contracts, then kofina to mocher limkor. Then we force the mocher to write the second contract because that was the condition of the sale, that he gets two contracts. He gets one contract written to the Reish Galuta and one contract written to himself, one to protect him from outside claims against the property and one to protect him against the Reish Galuta's family or inheritors coming to take the property from him. And since that was a condition of the sale, the seller knew that up front and it was a part and parcel of the sale, then we do compel him to write that second contract. Mara says, Amar, Elokeach Sadeh B'Shem Chevero, Ein kofin et mocher limkor zimna achrito. So now the Gemara goes back again to the Braita, the first part of the Braita, the way that we've explained it now, that if he sells it the first time and then he gets the one contract, that we do not compel him to write the second contract. Pshita, why should he have to write a second contract over there? Why is he obligated to write a second contract? He did what the mocher asked him at the time of the sale. Why is he now obligated to write a second contract? Malu de tema, we would have thought, Matzi amrle, he said to me yadat de anan lenafshe shalkilna. You know that the reason I'm buying this field is for myself. That was all disclosed at the time. Upanchaya ba'almahu dekaba'ina. And I just want this as a protection against people making claims or strong men coming and taking the property away. So you know that that panchaya or patzchaya might be the game, like pitzuchim, which is a cracking of a shell. I wanted some protection over here. And therefore, I wanted the contract for protection, and you knew that. So, and you know that I'm just not throwing my one away for no reason. And it was with the condition or in mind that you write me this other contract. From the context, basically, it's obvious what I'm doing here. I'm buying the field for myself. I'm having the contract written in the name of the Reish Galuta. And so you know I'm not throwing my money away for no reason. And I really want you to write another contract to myself. And so maybe we should have to compel the mocher to write the second contract. Kamash Malan, we can say, Damarlei, Inyana Avdilach Bahade Hau Dezavatle Bishme. Bichtov Lach Shtara Achrina. He says, I thought that you had some sort of, as Rashi says, inyona means a tnai, a condition, with the person that you had it sold to in his name and go to him and take care of it with him, and he'll write you the other shtar. So in that case, the seller can say, listen, I understand the circumstances. I did as you asked me. I wrote it to the Reish Galuta. Now, the buyer says, listen, you understood the circumstances, so you know I need a second shtar. He says, look, I had that, you already had it worked out with the other party, with the Reish Galuta, and then he was going to write you the shtar. I'm under no obligation to write you a second shtar because I did as we had agreed to at the time. And therefore, I do not have to write you a second shtar. If I've discharged my obligation, whatever you worked out with the Reish Galuta, that was outside of the parameters of the sale and the agreement that we came to. But, on the other hand, Ima Marlo Almanat, if he made that a condition of the sale, Kofina to Mocher Limkor, there we compel the Mocher to write the second contract. It says Pshita again. If it's specifically stated that he's going to write these two contracts, then of course we're going to obligate him to write the second contract. That was a condition of the sale. It says, lo, Tzricha, the Amarlu Lesade Kameh Didei. He says in front of the Edim. He didn't disclose it completely to the seller, but he does it in front of the Edim while the seller is standing there. Chazu d'shtara achrina ka be'inan. You see that I need another shtar in order to prove the fact that it's really my field and not the exarch's field. Maudu teima. Now, what we could think is maybe matzi amarle, the mocher, can say to him, amina shtara meheach the kashalach mishmei kamart. I thought when you said this in front of the Edim that you need another shtar that's going to evidence your ownership of the field, you really meant the other party that I wrote the shtar for him, he's going to give you a shtar. And he's the one who's going to provide the shtar, and I don't have to provide you any shtar. Kamash malan, damale, lahachi tarche, ba'amri luhu le'edim, kamach. That he says, no, that's the reason I specifically disclosed the information to the Edim in front of you. I could have just disclosed the information to the Edim. I did it specifically in front of you, the minachu de gabeina, because from you I want the contract, and that's why I made that a condition of the sale. And therefore, in the case where there was no stipulation in the sale for the second contract, the seller is not obligated then to provide the second contract. In the case where it was stipulated and the seller was aware of the fact that he wanted a second shtar, even though it wasn't made obvious that he was going to be the one providing it, nevertheless, since it's a condition of the sale, the seller is obligated to provide that second shtar. Rav Kahana, Yav Zuza Akitna. Rav Kahana put money down on some flax. L'sof Iyaker Kitna. In the end, the price of flax went up. Zavne Marvate de Kitna, the person who had the flax that Rav Kahana was buying from, went ahead and sold the flax, technically that was owned by Rav Kahana. After the coming to Rav, he came before Rav, Amalei Ma'ayavit, what should I do? Meaning that this guy sold out what was mine or what I had put money down on, and the price had appreciated, so I would have made the money, but now he sold it out and took the money. Israel Ishkelz was I, can I go back and take my money, meaning the profit that he got from selling the flax? Does that profit belong to me? Amrele, Rav says back to Rav Kahana, Ikar Zavne, Amre, at the time of the sale, if he specifically stated, Haikitna de Kahanahu, that this flax belongs to Rav Kahana, Zilshko, then you have the right to take it. Vilo, if he did not stipulate that, Lotishko, then you don't have a right to go take the appreciated value that was garnered from the flax. Kiman, who is that like? Kibane Marova. That's like the Bnei Marova that we saw yesterday and we quoted again earlier in the Gemara. Damrei mi'o di'o the Baal Chitim, shikne chitim the Baal Ma'ot. Because otherwise, how does the party that is there know that the transaction involves someone who is not present? Therefore, if he sold it in the name of Rav Kahana, then it's clear to the buyer that he's buying it from Rav Kahana and the money belongs to Rav Kahana. On the other hand, if he doesn't state Rav Kahana's name explicitly and in essence, he's not a shliach of Rav Kahana because Rav Kahana did not ask him to go ahead and sell this flax. Then he's acting on his own behalf and he's selling it for himself. Rav Kahana isn't mentioned in the picture. The buyer has no idea that he's buying it from Rav Kahana. He thinks he's buying it from the owner of the flax. And that means that the owner of the flax is, in essence, selling his own property to him. So if it's like the Bnei Marova that Rav is paskening that there was no clear transaction on behalf of Rav Kahana, and therefore the shliach, or here the person who owned the flax, is the one who takes possession of the money or the value that was sold, maybe you could say it differently. It's not that Rav Kahana is paying in 4 and getting back 8. Kitna memelahu diyakir. No, the price of flax went up by itself. It was a market price change. And migzel gazle. And the person who went and sold it from under him stole from Rav Kahana. Vitznan. And we have a Mishnah, Kol HaGazanim Mishalmim Kishat HaGzela. When you're a gazlan, you pay like the time that you stole. At the time that he sold it out to that party, that was a theft. The time of that theft, the prior kid price was higher. And therefore, Rav Kahana is entitled to the repayment of that gezel at the higher price. Amrei hotam amana havai. Now, the transaction with Rav Kahana wasn't as clear as you thought. You thought originally that Rav Kahana purchased the flax, made a kinyan in it, it was his. Then when the balabai goes and sells it out from under him, again, number one, you think, well, he can't be selling on behalf of Rav Kahana because he never discloses that. So when he sells it, he's selling it on behalf of himself, and therefore Rav Kahana is not entitled to it. That's what the Bnei Marava would say. Gemara says, well, that's not true, because Rav Kahana had possession of it. When he sold it, he stole it from Rav Kahana. And when stealing from Rav Kahana, he owes him the money at the time of the theft. The theft happened when he sold it at the higher price. That's the market price at that time. He owes Rav Kahana kashata gzela, that higher price, and he should have to repay him. So that's not the case. The Gemara says the case there was Rav Kahana bought on credit. He did not actually make a kinyan on the flax. They paid money to this individual to buy the flax at the lower market price. Velo mashche Rav Kahana, the kitna, and he never made a kinyan meshich on it. Virab l'tamei, and this is Rav l'shitato from Ezu Neshech in Bava Metzia, damarab osim amana beperot, vein osim amana bedamim. You can't buy on credit if it's done through the vehicle of the delivery of the actual item, but you can't do it if it's through damim, if it's through monetary payment. The reason being that what it looks like now is that Rav Kahana is paying him or telling him, buy me this at the lower market price. The guy says, no problem, I'll get it to you at the lower market price. Then he goes ahead and the market price goes up and he sells it. And then that money that he realizes at the higher market price is going to give to Rav Kahana. That looks like rebate according to Rav. You're paying in a lower amount of money and then you're getting back a higher amount of money without any kinyan on the payroll in between. So it looks like you're exactly what's happening here is he gave him money and he took back more money. That looks exactly like rebate. And therefore, Rav says that that's not permitted, even though it was done based on that credit, but there was never a kinyan on the flax. That lack of kinyan on the flax makes it that Rav Kahana never really owned anything because he had bought on credit. Since he didn't really own on it, we start to look at the optics of what's happening here. And Rav Kahana is handing in a smaller amount of money and getting about a bigger amount of money. That looks like rebate. Tosfot over here clarifies that even in that situation, even Rabbi Yanai, who argues on Rav in the case in Bava Metzia and says this is not rebeat, agrees that in this scenario that we laid out here, it would be problematic. Because he only agrees or only argues on Rav when the seller has the item in hand. Meaning that the seller has flax at that moment, and he makes a choice not to hand him the flax, but rather to say, I'll give it to you in the future. So here he buys it at the market price today, which is the lower market price. Then the seller has an option. He can give it to him right now because he has it in hand, or he can decide to pay him later. He decides to give it to him later at the higher market price. That's fine because he had the option at that moment to give him the flax. But in our scenario over here, at least the way Rashi is describing it, that if there was no flax available, the guy didn't have the flax now. He basically said to him, here's the money. Here's the market price today. I want to purchase it at the current market price, even though you don't have it in hand. You're going to go buy it. You're going to source it for me. I want to buy it at the current market price today. But he didn't have it in hand. If he didn't have it in hand, even Rabbi Yanai agrees that then you have a problem of rebeat because he didn't have the option to fulfill his obligation immediately with peirot. And therefore, it's considered to be rebeat, even according to Rabbi Yanai. Therefore, Tosafot suggests, in order to help understand the position of Rashi, says, that's only a case where it's a loan. The low shari abiyana elekshieshlo peirot davka. That can only be done when he has the opportunity, the option to pay him back in peirot immediately. But aval zvine, over here where it's a transaction, it wasn't a loan, it was a transaction. Marhatam de poskim ashar shebeshuk. There you're allowed to set the transaction at the going price in the market. Because even if he doesn't have the fruits in hand, he can go out to the market immediately and buy whatever he had promised, because that is the going market price. So therefore, even if he doesn't personally have it in hand, since the market price is that, he can go out and replace this money with whatever he's supposed to deliver. And since he has that opportunity, it's not rebeat. And over there, Rabbi Yanai will say it's mutar, and Rav will say it's asur, and Rav is pasking like his shita. So again, to go over the case here, Rav Kahana puts money down based on the current market price, which is a lower market price. The individual then says he'll give it back to him later on at the time when the market prices are higher. According to Rav, that's already a problem, since the delivery is coming in cash and not in payrot, the problem is that you have cash going in, cash coming out. That's a problem because it looks like ribit. You're handing him less money, getting back more money. Looks like you're basically charging him interest for the money that you lent them up front. On the other hand, for Rabbi Yannai, since there was a going market price when you gave him the money, and he had the option to fulfill your order immediately, and he chose not to, and he chose to wait till the later time period, then it's his decision. And his decision, it's fine, because this is a transactional situation, not a situation in which you're lending him the money. Therefore, he has the right to deliver it later on. And since he has that right, he can deliver you it or give you the cost of what it is later on. And based on that, it would be mutar to do it, even though you're getting a larger sum of the money for the smaller sum of money that you're giving today. But Rav Lishitato says to Rav Kahana that you have no rights to this money now because it looks like ribit. And we're not going to allow you to give the money now and get it back a larger sum later. First of all, you have no kinyan on the payrot, so there's no gezel over here. You can't charge him for the higher price because he stole it from you. And number two is, you can't leave the transaction as it is and just take your largest sum of money back and pay him the lower sum of money because that looks like ribit. And so the Rav Shittato says, Rav Kahana, you have no recourse over here against this individual who basically was somewhat unfair in his business practices because he had committed to Rav Kahana, but there was no kinyan. And so that commitment, according to Rav, makes it that he can no longer collect on it because of the fact that it would look like ribit if he took the cash back in the end. If he took delivery of the flax itself, then it would be mutar. So had he not sold out the flax, and had he delivered the flax to Rabbi Yannai, it would have been fine, even according to Rav. But now, according to Rav, where he sold the flax, and all he can give him back is the higher amount of money, that's not permitted according to Rav. According to Rabbi Yannai, it would be permitted even to get that larger sum of money back, not delivery of the flax, and therefore, Rav Kahana would have a claim against him to get that larger sum of money, according to Rabbi Yannai. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah refers to the Parshia at the end of Perkei in Vayikra, which speaks about the Asham Gzelot. Asham Gzelot is a case in which an individual owes money, but then denies the fact that he owes this money, and then he denies it under oath. And that's what it says, Nefesh ki techata umala mal bashem, bikichesh bamito. He denies to his friend, bipikadon, a case where the person entrusted him with some item and he denies having the item. Oh, bitsumet yad, or with regards to a loan that was extended to him, he denies the fact that he owes the loan back. Oh, bigazel, or something that he stole, he denies the fact that he has it. Oh, ashaket amito, or he withheld the wages of some individual who he owes the money to and he denies that he owes the wages. Oh, matza aveda, or he finds something that was a lost item and he denies the fact that he has it or that this belongs to that other individual. V'kicheshba, he denies it, v'nishba l'shoker, and he takes a shvua to that effect that he doesn't owe it. Alachad mikol ha'she'aseh adam l'chato beina. Then, if he wants to then give back the gezel, not here, but in Sefer Bamidbar, it indicates that he has to be hodeh, that he has to admit to the fact that he did something wrong. If he admits to the fact that after he denied it and took a shvua, he admits to the fact that he really owes the money, then in that case he must pay back. Oh, mikol ha'she'aseh alav l'sheker v'shilam oto b'rosho, v'chamishitav yosef alav. He has to pay back the keren plus 1/5 on top of that, which is really 25% of the number, 1/5 of the total sum after the fact. That he has to give it back. V'asher hu lo yitnenu b'yom hashmato. He has to ensure that it gets back to the individual to whom he had sinned or denied the fact. In addition to that, he has to bring an asham gzelot, in order to be mitchaper on the fact that he took a shvuat sheker and did something wrong over here. So the individual, after denying it and taking a shvuat sheker, admits to that wrongdoing. In that case, he packs back 1/5 to the owner of who he denied the money. Plus, he has to bring a korban and asham gzelot. So that's what our Mishnah is discussing. A gozelet chavero shaveh pruta, v'nishba lo, and then he takes a shvua denying it. Yolichenu acharav afilu l'madai. He has to take it out to him, even to madai. Madai being an example of a far-flung place. As Rashi notes over here, it's even a place where the cost of getting the money there is worth more than the underlying amount that he owes. Nevertheless, he's got to take it there. And we're going to see the reason being is because the pasuk says, "Lasher hu lo itnenu." There's a demand in the pasuk that you return it specifically to the individual to whom you stole it. Therefore, wherever he is, you got to find him and return the money. Lo iten lo livno, v'lo lishluchu. he's not able or allowed to give it to a son or the shliach of the nigzal to take it out to the nigzal. Now, the truth is he can give it to them, but that is not deemed as if he's returned the item already. Until it reaches the hand of the person from whom he stole it, then it's considered lasher hulo. Then he gave it back to him. If he hands it to the son of that individual or to the shliach of that individual, it's still not considered or classified as if it got back to him. And if something happens to the money before it reaches the nigzal, he will not have discharged his obligation to return it to that party. So the Mishnah suggests, don't give it to them, because you won't discard your obligation then until it reaches them anyway. And you'll be responsible all along until it reaches him. Aval, what he can do is notein l'shliach beitin. He can give it to the shliach beitin. Rashi over here says that shliach beitin is synonymous with takanta hu David rabbanam yipnei takanat shavim. It's synonymous with the takanat shavim that we've seen until now in our Mishnayot. Then we're not going to force this guy to put out tons of money on the travel expenses in order for him to get it to the person who he owes it, and then he's not going to want to do tshuva. He can return the money, but meantime he's going to have to expend more and more and more money to get it back to him, much more than he stole. So in order to facilitate, help this person to do tshuva as part of takanat shavim, we say that he can drop it off at Beit Din, and in dropping it off at Beit Din, he discharges his obligation, and wherever the nigzal wants, he can come and pick it up. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosfot, on the other hand, believes that that's not the case here. And he says that this is a totally different takana, not of takanat shavim, but rather that you're allowed to utilize a shliach beit din that happens to be traveling to that location. You can utilize him to bring the money to the individual. And once you've given it to the shliach beit din, you've discharged your obligation. So unlike the parties before, where if you give it to them, you have not discharged your obligation until it reaches the nigzal, over here, if you hand it to the shliach beit din, you've discharged your obligation, and you are, now something happens, it's the problem of the beit din, or basically you've sent it in an insured manner by which you will not be responsible anymore. And that's what the takana was, that we allow him to use the shliach beit din and to discharge his obligation through the shliach beit din. Now, it's not clear from the Balei Tosafot as to whether he has to pay the shliach beit din for his services. It could be that the shliach beit din was going anyway, and therefore it was no extra expenditure. Or it might be that he does have to pay the cost of the travels of the shliach beit din, but it's still worth it to him because he's sending it with someone who, by the moment he gives it to him, he's done, and he doesn't have to worry about whether it ever does or does not reach the nigzal. Tosafot notes, that's the takana here, and not the takanat shavim. Now, imate, yachzir liyorshav. If the nigzal passes away, then you have to discharge the obligation of returning it to the nigzal by giving it to his yorshim. Now, Tosfot says, why isn't that obvious? Of course you have to give it back. So Tosfot gives two reasons for the chiddush in the Mishnah. The first one is that, just like you have to return it to the hands of the nigzal, so too there's an obligation for you to return it to the hands of the yorshim. And you don't simply discharge your obligation by saying, here's the money, come and get it. Just like you have to take it out to the nigzal, you'll have to take it out to Zyorshim in order to gain kapara. The other chiddush possibly is that in the reverse case, where the gazlan passes away, the children are not obligated to do what the gazlan does, which is that the gazlan himself will have to pay 1 1/5, whereas his children are not obligated to pay the additional chomesh. So you see here there's a change in the din between the gazlan himself and his children. You would have thought maybe there's a similar difference between the nigzal and his children. The Mishnah comes along to say there's no difference between the children of the nigzal and the nigzal himself. So for one of those two reasons, Tosafot says, the Mishnah specifies that the yorshim of the nigzal have the same status as the nigzal. Natan lo et hakeren, velo natan lo et hachomesh. If he repaid the keren to the nigzal and got it to his hand, but he had yet to pay the chomesh, machal lo al hakeren, velo machal lo al hachomesh. The nigzal waived the necessity to pay him the core amount, the principal amount, but did not forgive him with regards to the chomesh. O machal lo al zeh v'al zeh. Or he forgave him for everything. Chutz mipachat shoveh to bekeren. They left over less than a shoveh pruta worth of value in the principal amount. Eino tzarich lelech acharav. He does not obligated to go chase him down and to pay him back. So, first of all, in terms of less than a pruta, we're going to see this a number of times in the Mishnah, anything that is below the threshold of the pruta is considered to be de minimis or too small to deal with. There is an iser for stealing that amount of money, but there's no obligation of hashava. Hashava, or the obligations of return, only come when you've exceeded the threshold of a pruta, because generally below a pruta, we assume people are a mochel, or it's too small to be bothered with, and therefore there are no expectations of you returning it. So therefore, if it reaches below that threshold, there's no longer an obligation to return it. Again, there still is an iser in stealing less than a pruta, but nevertheless, there may not be any obligation of return, and that's what the Mishnah here says in that last case. In the prior two cases that the Mishnah brought, it says that if the keren is already been discharged, either because he paid the principal back or because it was forgiven, then the chomesh itself does not have an obligation to be returned independently. Meaning that once the keren is paid, the chomesh does not have this obligation to be returned directly to the individual. And that some point out, because in the pasuk it says, lasher hu lo yitnenu, so there it's not written yitnaim in the plural form, meaning that the principal and the chamishit, lasher lo yitnenu was just referring to the keren. And since that's the case, it only has the obligation to ensure that what's returned to the nigzal directly in hand is the keren, and not the chomesh. On the other hand, natan lo et the chomesh, but no natan lo et the keren. If he returned the chomesh, but not the principal amount, machal lo al chomesh, or the guy, the nigzal, forgave him on the additional fifth, v'lo machal lo al keren, and did not forgive him about the principal amount, machal lo al zeh v'azeh chutz mishaveh pruta b'keren, or he forgave the whole amount, but he left over a pruta's worth of the keren that he does have to return, tzarich l'alich acharav, he has to chase him down and return it. There the obligation still exists on him to return it, because the keren, or the owing of the keren, is still extant. As long as it's above that threshold of a pruta, he has an obligation to return in each of those instances to the nigzal. And the three cases, as you note in each section here of the Mishnah, move to a more and more extreme form, which is that in the first case where we said, oh, he paid the whole keren, there was just a chomesh left over. He was forgiven the keren, there's just a chomesh. He forgave everything except less than a pruta's worth. In all those cases, we say, doesn't have to return it. Over here, it's the opposite way around, which is that, oh, he paid off the chomesh, she has the keren. He was forgiven for the chomesh, he has the keren. He was forgiven for everything, but there's still a pruta left. He still has to go out. Each case says that even in a case where it seems less likely that he has to return it, he still has to return the item or the keren directly to the owner in that case. Now, if natan lo et the keren, if he gave back the keren, v'nishba lo al chomesh, he returns the principal amount, and then the nigzal claims from him and says, you still owe me a chomesh. And he denies that. Not only does he deny it, he denies it under oath. And so basically what he's done is recreated a new case of denying something that you owe under oath. Then the chomesh, the fifth that he owns, becomes the new keren, the new principal amount. And therefore he pays a chomesh on top of that chomesh. We've seen this actually earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara will discuss it, because there it says, v'chamishitav yusif alav, and that seems like there are chamishiot harbei. There are many chamishiot that you can pay. That means if you deny owing the chamishit and take a shvuat that effect and later admit you owe it, you will not only have to pay that chomesh back, but you'll pay a chomesh on the chomesh, adshi ma'eta keren mishave pruta, until the principal amount is less than a pruta. We're not going to make, first of all, take a shvuat, but also there's no obligation in terms of asham gzelot and the payment of a chomesh if the keren, if the principal amount is less than a chomesh. So once the chomesh that you took a shvuat precipitates a payment of a fifth that is less than a chomesh, that next chomesh cannot become a principal amount, which will obligate you in a chomesh, because it's less than a pruta. Now, even though, as Tosfot points out, that in terms of taking a shvuah in Beit Din, you only take a shvuah in Beit Din if there's a claim of shtei kesef and a denial of a shove pruta. So over here, Tosfot either says that our Mishnah is talking about a case where he's taking the shvuah outside of Beit Din, and the case of Asham Gzelot applies for a shvuah not only in Beit Din, but also outside of Beit Din. Or the scenario is in a case where it was a claim of shtei kesef, and he admitted to a shove pruta, and then afterwards denied that shove pruta. And therefore that's how we got to a shove pruta, even though it was a shvuat Beit Din, meaning the shvuah has been taken in Beit Din because it met the requirements to have a shvuat Beit Din, and he'll still end up in this scenario where he's only taking a shvuah about a pruta. Then the Mishnah says, v'chein b'pikadon. This is not only true when we're talking about gzela, but also talking about a pikadon. Shenemar o b'pikadon. As we read in the pasuk, it's not only applicable to gzelot, but also things that are entrusted with you. O b'tsumet yad, which is, we said, dealing with loans, if you deny the fact that someone lent you money. O b'gazel, which is what the Mishnah was speaking about until now. O ashaket amito, which is a case where he denies owing the schar, the wages of an individual. O matzav veda, or he found something and denies having it or having to return it to this individual. V'kichesh ba, denies it, nishpa l'sheker. Harzeh mishalem keren v'chomesh v'asham. That is the obligation of asham gzelot, where once he admits to the fact that he has denied it, taken a shvuah, and admits to the fact that he was wrong or lying about that, He has to return the principal amount plus a chomesh plus the asham. Now the Gemara says, our Mishnah says, nishbalo in, lo nishbalo lo. That this obligation to return it all the way to the individual who was an exal, making sure that it gets to him, is only true when you took a shvu'ah, and it enters you into this world of asham gzelot, because that's where the pasuk says, asher hu lo yitnenu, that you have to get it back to the individual himself in hand. But when it comes to regular gzela, it just says, v'shivat gzela, asher gazal, you have to make it available, you have to return it to him. Never makes that specific statement about returning it to the individual themselves. So our Mishnah says that that's predicated on the fact that he took a shvu'ah. But if he didn't take it a shvu'ah, then he wouldn't have that obligation. Mani. Who is the author of our Mishnah then? Lo Rabbi Tarfon, velo Rabbi Akiva. It's neither Rabbi Akiva nor Rabbi Tarfon. D'tanya. We have a braita. Gazal echad mi'chamisha. If he steals from one of five people, ve'en yodea me'ezem ehen, and he has no idea of those five people, he doesn't know which one of them he stole from. He agrees he stole from one of them, and all five of them are making a claim against him, but he doesn't know which one is the right person. V'chol echad omer oti gazal, and all of them say, you stole from me. Meniach gzela b'nehem u'mistalek divi Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon says he puts the money back that he needs to repay between them, and let them fight it out and figure out who is the nigzal. He's accomplished, according to Rabbi Tarfon, v'shivet gzela asher gazal, by simply disposing of the money in front of them. Now Tosfot says he doesn't just drop the money off in front of them, he gives it to the Beit Din, and then they work it out in Beit Din, because if he leaves it in front of them, then there could be a problem that doesn't get to the right individual. Rabbi Kiva omer, lo zo derech motzioto midei aveira. That's not going to solve his problem here, or get him out of the problem of the aveira. Ad shishalem gzela l'kol echad v'echad. He needs to repay each individual that is there in order to ensure that he's accomplished v'shivet gzela asher gazal. So there is here a machlok between Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Kiva as to how you accomplish v'shivet gzela asher gazal. According to Rabbi Kiva, it's very clear that v'shivet gzela asher gazal means that you return it to the rightful owner. Unless it reaches the rightful owner, you have not accomplished v'shivet gzela asher gazal. And so therefore, just simply putting the money out and giving it to Beit Din, you have not discharged your obligation. On the other hand, according to Rabbi Tarfon, the disgorgement of the gezel and giving over to Beit Din suffices in terms of v'shivet gzela. You did what was incumbent upon you. Okay, these individuals, they've got to work out who it belongs to. But as far as you're concerned, you return the gzela. They have to figure out who it goes to, but that's not part of your obligation. Your obligation is to make sure that it was disgorged, and it's available to whoever is the rightful owner of the money. And you accomplish that by giving that money over to the Beit Din. So as long as the nigzal is aware of the fact that you've returned the money, that suffices to accomplish v'shivat gzela asher gazal. Now Tosfot points out over here that we have a machloket later on in the Masechta as to whether when you have bari v'shema, one of the claimants has a definitive claim, and the other party doesn't know, or says maybe, that bari odif, according to some amorim, according to other amorim, it doesn't matter. So now over here, why don't we say that there are five guys making a bari, a definitive claim that he's owed money, and this guy goes, shema, maybe. So Tosfot says that's not true, because this guy says, bari, that four of them are lying. He knows for certain, and he has a definitive response that of four of you I know are lying. It's only about the one of them that I don't know. And therefore, that offsets the definitive claims, and therefore, bari and adif will not play a role over here. Or even according to those that say, bari and shema, the bari is not adif, they can still hold like Rabbi Akiva over here, and say that he has to return it to each party, because it has nothing to do with the fact that the guys are making a definitive claim. It all has to do with the admission of the gazlan that he did steal from one of these five parties. And that's what's obligating him over here, not the definitive claims of the other parties. So Tosfot says that machloket of bari and shema, whether it's adif or not, does not necessarily corner you into either holding like Rabbi Tarfon or Rabbi Akiva, because even the one who says that bari adif can hold like Rabbi Tarfon, and the one who says that bari is not adif can even hold like Rabbi Akiva. So Mani, which of these two Tanaim is going to be the author of our Mishnah? E Rabbi Tarfon. If it's Rabbi Tarfon, Alpha Gav Dishtaba, he says whether you did take a shvuah or didn't take a shvuah, Mar Meniach Gzela Benehem U'Mistalek. You put the Gzela down and say it's your problem. E Rabbi Akiva, Alpha Gav Delo Ishtaba. For Rabbi Akiva, even if he didn't take a shvuah, Amar Yishalem Gzela L'Kol Echad B'Echad, he has to reach the individuals. So Rabbi Akiva can't be the author of the Mishnah, because Rabbi Akiva says whether you take a shvuah or not, you're still obligated to ensure that the money reaches the party or the intended party. For Rabbi Tarfon, he can't be the author of our Mishnah, because he says whether you do or don't take a shvuah, all your obligation is to disgorge the money, make it available to the owner, and he has to come and get it when he wants. You don't have to get it to him directly or into his hand, and that's not like our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says if you take a shvuah, then you do have that obligation. So Gemara attempts first to set it up like Rabbi Akiva. Lo'olam Rabbi Akiva hi. The reason to do that, Rashi and Tosafot over here, note, the reason to do that is, first of all, that Stam Mishnayot are all Aliba de Rabbi Akiva, which is that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva are the authors of most of the Mishnayot, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda. These are all Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, and therefore we would want the Mishnah to follow Rabbi Akiva's position, because that would make sense. Number two is that in a machloket of Yechidim, which is Rabbi Akiva and another Tana, the Halach is always like Rabbi Akiva. So over here too, we would assume that the Halach is like Rabbi Akiva, and therefore we'd want to set up our Mishnah, Liba de Hilchata. So that's why the Gemara gravitates first to setting up the Mishnah like Rabbi Akiva. V'chikam Rabbi Akiva ad shishalim gzila l'kol echad v'echad. When is there an obligation to pay the gzila to each individual? Hechadish tabahu dikamar. That's only when he took a shvua. My taima. Why is there an extra obligation when he takes a shvua to return it directly to the nigzal? Damakra la sherhu lo yitnenu ba'om mashmato. The puzzle that we've been quoting all along, that there's an additional obligation there. But when it comes to regular gzela, he will agree with Rabbi Tarfon, Veshivat gzela asher gazal is sufficient just to disclose to the individual that you've turned the item. Rabbi Tarfon, afagav dishtaba avud rabbana takanta. But Rabbi Tarfon believes, even though the pasuk says like Rabbi Akiva, and technically he's right, Rabbi Akiva is right, but the Chachamim instituted a takana over here, which we know as takana tashavim, which facilitated the ability of the person to return it without having to pay every party that's here, or without having to take it out to the person who's far-flung place and have to expend money to get it back to him. Titanio, they made this big takana, or this tremendous takana. It's called a takana gdola because it goes against the Torah, which is she'im haita hutza yetera lekeren. If the expenditures to return the money exceed the value of the money that he stole, shleim keren v'chomesh lebeitin, he deposits the keren, the chomesh, and the beitin. He brings his asham and he gets his kapara, meaning that he discharges his obligation by simply dropping it off in Beit Din. So according to this, the machloket that we saw before Rabbi Diva and Rabbi Tarfon is not in a case of regular gzela. In the case of regular gzela, even Rabbi Akiva will agree, Veshivat gzela asher gazal, sufficient to just notify the balim to hand it back. Their machloket is in a case of shvua, where he did take a shvua, and the pasuk of asher lehu lo yitnenu is invoked. Rabbi Akiva says the deoraita obligations return it to the individual in hand. And therefore, if you have five people making a claim here, he's got to give all five of them to discharge his obligation, because otherwise he hasn't attained kapara. Now then, Rabbi Tarfon says this is the takanat shavim that the Chachamim instituted, that despite the fact that the Torah obligates him to return it to that specific individual, nevertheless, they exempted him from that in order to facilitate his ability to do tshuva. And therefore, he hands it to the Beit Din, and he's done whatever he has been obligated to do. And Rabbi Akiva explains here, Ki avod rabbanan takanto. When did the rabbanan put this takana in place? Hechad yado leman gazle. That's only true when he knows who he stole from. The kamahadele mimono lemarit. Because then he's returning the money to the individual by placing it into the Beit Din. But gazal echad mi chamisha. Delo yado leman gazle. Over there, he doesn't know who he stole from. Delo hader mimono lemarit. And the money's not going to end up with the proper owner. Lo avod rabbanan takanto. Over there, the Rabbanan didn't put an institution in place. I mean, the institution was only put in place for cases where he knows who it's getting back to. Therefore, when he deposits it in Beit Din, they notify the Balim. In the end, it will end up in the hands of the Balim, because we have the right Balim. But in a case where there are five parties fighting over who is the proper recipient of this money, then he doesn't accomplish anything when he puts it in Beit Din, because it still doesn't end up in the hands of the proper owner. And therefore, the Takana doesn't apply to him. That's the way that Rashi explains it over here. You can see that Avod Rabbanan Takanta, which is Tanakat Hashavim. And according to Rashi, Lishitato, that's what our Mishnah said, that you're allowed to give it over to the Shliach Beit Din, that you're allowed to hand it over to the Beit Din as part of Takanat Hashavim. And what Rabbi Tarfon does is extrapolates that din of Takanat Shavim from our Mishnah to a case of Echad Mechamisha, and says the same thing over there. So that's why Rashi, consistent with the Shita, says that the Mishnah is talking about a case of Takanat Hashavim. And so too, over here, we're talking about a Takanat Hashavim. The only question is, does it extend beyond that? Rabbi Tarfon says, yes, from our Mishnah it extends even to the case of Echad Mechamisha. Whereas Rabbi Akiva, he says, what is in the Mishnah is Takanat Shavim. But beyond that, we don't extend that Takana. The problem with that pshat, as Tosfot points out, is that then Rabbi Tarfon can equally be the author of our Mishnah. Because both of them agree, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, that there is this Takanat Shavim, and it does apply to the case of our Mishnah. So then why is the Gemara forcing it towards Rabbi Akiva? That might be answered by what Rashi had said before. Those would have said the same thing, but we try to stand it like Rabbi Akiva, because of the fact that Rabbi Akiva is the quote-unquote father of authorship of all the Mishnayot and Tanaic works, as well as the fact that Rabbi did halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. But for that reason, Tosafot thinks that the Mishnah and the case here are totally different. The Mishnah, as we said before, going to the Balei Tosafot, the Takana there is that you can give it over to a Shliach Beit Din, and then you have discharged all your obligations with regards to returning it. But it has nothing to do with Takanat HaShavim. And our Mishnah is actually a different than this case here, or this case of the Takanat HaShavim. Our Mishnah basically says that no matter what the expenditures are, that you have to get it either to the person themselves, or to the closest Beit Din. No matter what the undertaking is to get it there, Rabbi Akiva, who will be the author of our Mishnah, says that Takanat HaShavim allows you to bring it to a Beit Din, or to the individual themselves, no matter what the cost is. So it's easier for you to get it to a Beit Din, fine. But it doesn't matter what the cost is for you to get it to the Beit Din, even if that exceeds the value of the principal, you still have to get it to a Beit Din. And that's what Rabbi Akiva says, the Takanat HaShavim applies, but we know who the person is that you stole from. That way, if you return it to him or to the Beit Din, you've discharged your obligation no matter what the cost of that is. Rabbi Tarfon, on the other hand, says, no, there's a limit to that. That the limitation is if you cannot find a Beit Din or the individual close enough to you or in a reasonable distance or expenditure, then you don't have to do it. So if you have to expend more than the principal amount, you keep it with you. You don't have to return it to the Beit Din. You don't have to return it to anyone. You hold on to it until you're close enough to a location where it pays for you to give it to a Beit Din or to the other individual. And that's the machloket here between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Akiva says, our Mishnah does not allow you to keep it, does not allow you to get out of the obligation of returning when the cost exceeds the value of the principal. And it tells you, you have to either give it to a Beit Din or you have to give it to the individual himself. Rabbi Tarfon says, yes, you can give it to a Beit Din or to the person themselves, but there's an additional kula here, which is that if the price exceeds the value of the Karen, then we don't obligate you to do it. And that's the kula of Rabbi Tarfon, and that's why Rabbi Tarfon cannot be the author of our Mishnah, and why Rabbi Akiva is the author of our Mishnah, according to that view of the Balei Tosafot. So, Meiti Rav Huna Bar Yehuda. Am Rabbi Shimon Elazar, lo nechluku Rabbi Tarfon Rabbi Akiva, ashlakach echad mechamisha, venu yudea meizem lakach. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva don't argue in a case of a purchase, in which the person bought something from one of five people, and he doesn't know who he purchased it from to pay them for the merchandise that he bought. Even Rabbi Akiva will agree in that case. He puts down the money and says, you guys figure out who the money belongs to or who I purchased it from. Their machloket is shegazal echad mechamisha bnei adam. It's only in the case of theft. And I don't know which one of them I stole from. Rabbi Tarfon Omer Minyach Dmei Gzela Bineihem. The Rabbi Tarfon says you put it down again, like Tosfot says you give it to the Beit Din and they have to work it out. Umistalek and you walk away. Rabbi Akiva Omer Ein Lo Takana Ad Shiyur Shalem Gzela Lekol Echad Beechad. Rabbi Akiva the Shitero says you have to make sure that each person gets the money because otherwise you haven't discharged your obligation to return the Gzela. V'Salkadatcho Dishtaba. If you say this is a case of taking a Shvua where he denied owing money, meaning that he stole something and denies the fact that he stole it. Or he purchased something and denies the fact that he purchased it and then took a shvua to that effect and now admits to the fact that he's taken that shvua falsely. Mali lakach, mali gazal. Why does it matter whether it was a purchase or a gzela? Because the psukim, as we saw before, indicate that the denial in any of those cases is problematic. So if he entered into a case of Hashem gzelot, it makes no difference between lekicha and gzela. That means that the way that Rav Huna Rabbi Yehuda is setting up the machloket between Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, it has nothing to do with our Mishnah, because our Mishnah is a case where there's no differentiation between whether he purchased it and denied purchasing it, or he stole it and he denied stealing it. Vod meiti Rava, and Rava also challenges this explanation of our Mishnah. Maseh b'chasid echad shlakach mishnei bnei adam, v'lo yodea meizem en lakach. Individual, a chasid, purchased from one of two individuals, and he didn't know who he had purchased from. Ubalifnei Rabbi Tarfon. Comes to Rabbi Tarfon, Malo, hanach demei mechcha b'nehem v'istalek. Go put your money down between them, let them work it out, and you've done your obligation. Ubalifnei Rabbi Akiva, amar lo, ein lecha takana, ashi tishalem dekol echad v'echad. There is no fixing of this until you pay each one of the individuals. So it's clear here that this bright of chasid echad argues on Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, because here it says that the machlok between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon persists even in a case of a purchase, not just in a case of gezel, or the difference being whether it came into your hand be isur, gezel, or whether it came into your hand beheter through lekicha. In either one of those cases, you still have the same obligation in terms of paying the parties. So it definitely argues Rabbi Shimon Elazar, but it's also a problem for using that to explain our Mishnah. V'isagadatcha demishtaba chasid mimishtaba b'shikra. If you say that this whole machloket between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon applies even in cases of Asham Gzelot, where he denied it, took a false shvuah, why is this person called a chasid? A chasid is someone who doesn't take false shvuot. V'chitema demishtaba b'had Rabbi chasid. You're going to tell me that, wait, oh, he took a shvuah checker, and then he did shuvah, and now he's a chasid. The Gemara gives us a principle in Tmurah that anytime the Gemara or a Braita or a Mishnah uses the term Chasid Echad, it refers to one of these two Tanaim. O Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, O Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Eli. And those are people, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli, Chasidim Yikarabu. They aren't people who did Shuvah, they were Chasidim throughout their life. And we wouldn't have expected them to take a false Shvuah. If that's the case, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon are stating their opinions, nothing to do with a Shvuah over here. It has nothing to do with Shvuah Checker. That's not where their machloket is. Their machloket is even in a case where there was no Shvuah. And therefore, you can't establish that Rabbi Kiva is the author of the Mishnah. Elo le'olam. So now the Gemara has to back out and say Rabbi Tarfon is the author of our Mishnah. Umode Rabbi Tarfon echidishtaba. And Rabbi Tarfon agrees in a case where you take a Shvuah, he agrees to the position of Rabbi Akiva. My taima. Damakra, because there the pasuk says, "Asher hu lo yitnanu biyom ashmato." So here, what Rabbi Tarfon says is, when it's veishivit agzela asher gazal, he argues with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says, "Oh, you have to get it back to the individual you stole from; otherwise, you have a discharge obligation." Rabbi Tarfon says, "You just have to make them aware of the fact that you've returned it, disgorged the item, and you're done with what you have to do. They can work out about getting it physically, and that's true both gzela or lekicha, according to the story of Chasid Echad. According to Rabbi Shimon Gazar, it's only true by gzela." But in the case of Asham Gzelot, where he denied it, then took a Shvuah checker, and then admitted to it, even Rabbi Tarfon agrees you have to get it back to each individual in order to discharge your obligation, because it says, Asher hu lo yitnenu, there's a specific charge in the Pasuk to ensure that it gets to the party who was stolen from. Rabbi Kiva, afagav delo mishtaba konis. Rabbi Kiva, on the other hand, says, even without a Shvuah, he puts a Knas in place, and says that you have to return it to the party themselves. So it's interesting here, because then it's not Mi'ikar Adin that Rabbi Kiva believes that you have to return it to each individual. It's a Knas, because in the case of Asham Gzelot, you would have to return it. Over here, he's Kones, to ensure that the person who was wronged gets their money back. And therefore, it's a Knas over here. So Rabbi Kiva thinks there's no difference between Shvuah or no Shvuah. With a Shvuah, Mido, right, that you have to return it to the particular party. Without a Shvuah, there's a Knas that you must return it. But Rabbi Tarfon, on the other hand, believes that, yes, when it's a Shvuah, and they'll write that you're demanded to give it back, you have to give it back to the party. But when there's no Shvuah, then you just leave the money in Beit Din, and you're fine. And so therefore, Rabbi Tarfon will be the author of the Mishnah, which distinguishes between taking a Shvuah and not taking a Shvuah checker. Michte. Where it says, wait a minute. Heichi de mishtaba losagil de lohode. Obviously, if you take a Shvuah checker, the only way for you to be obligated in the case of Asham Gzelot is if you admit the fact that you did something wrong. Mayuria vinishba. Why does it matter if he took a Shvuah, afilo below Shvuah Nami, even without a Shvuah too? Because, as Rashi says over here, the kapara v'shavon dekra ahodektiv, that when the person wants to do the right thing here, it's a case where he admits to doing something wrong. That's found in Bamidbar Hey, where it speaks about v'hidvadu et chatadam, which I spoke about before, that in order to be chayav in Hashem Zelot, you have to admit to the fact that you lied under oath about denying whatever you owed. So therefore, this person, as Tosfot says, is initiating the fact that he wants to do tshuva. And he says, V'kevin shahoda mistama ba'letzet yidei shemaim. And a person who admits and wants to do tshuva wants to do it completely right. And if that's the case, even Rabbi Tarfon should agree that in that instance, the individual has to get it to all parties. Whether it is because he took a shvuah checker, whether it's that he did not take a shvuah checker, the fact that he's admitting to doing something wrong here, that already is an impetus to say this guy wants to do the proper thing. If he wants to do the proper thing, there's no necessity for takanat shavim here. There's no necessity to protect the individual, to help him or facilitate him, because he's already in the position where he wants to do tshuva. And if he wants to do it, he's going to do it right. And he's going to make sure or ensure that it gets to every person. Datanya, Moshe Rabbi Tarfon, Bomer l'shnayim gazalti echad mikem, that if he goes to two people and admits the fact that he stole from one of them, maneh, 100 zuz, en yodei zemikem, and I don't know which one of you, noten l'ze maneh, u'l'ze maneh. That he has to give each one of them an ex kvar hodem mipiatzmo, because he already admitted to the fact that he stole or that he is trying to do it. And as Rashi says again, ubalitzet yidei shemayim, he's trying to be yotzei mitzrayim. So afagav, even though Beit Din will not obligate him to pay each individual, but he's not out of the ownership. He doesn't attain kapara until it reaches the party that it's supposed to reach, even according to Rabbi Tarfon. Now Tosfot says, now according to this explanation, Rabbi Tarfon, then how do we explain that Breita Maseh b'Chassid Echad who came before Rabbi Tarfon says, I bought from one of two individuals, I don't know who to pay. And Rabbi Tarfon says, leave it between them. Wait a minute, this guy, this Chassid who's coming here is coming to, let's say, Yedei Shemayim. So why didn't he tell him to pay both parties? So Tosfot says, either the case there was the Chatchila, whether Beit Din could obligate him or not, that was the question at hand. Or he nami, I feel it say Yedei Shemayim ain't chayav the Rabbi Tarfon, it'll be gazel. Maybe according to Rabbi Tarfon, let's say Yedei Shemayim is only an obligation when you stole. Aval pikadon mekach to lo asa isur alo. But in the case of pikadon mekach, where it came into your hands not through isur, over there, let's say Yedei Shemayim, you do not have to ensure that it gets to all parties because it came to you beheter. Since it came to beheter, you can then leave it up to the other parties to solve the problem and you discharge your obligation that way. So that's how we'll explain the case of Masir bechassid echad. But now again, we're in a bind because according to Rabbi Tarfon, whether you took a shvuah or not, you have to pay all parties. And so therefore, again, he can't be the author of our Mishnah, which distinguishes between a case of shvuah, where you have to return it directly to the party, and a case where there is no shvuah, where you don't have to return it directly to the party. So, Amarova, shiny matnitin. Our Mishnah is a different case. Came in diyada leman gazle, v'odile. There he knows exactly from whom he stole, v'odile, and he admitted to it. Came in defshalar dure mamona lemare, since he has the opportunity or the possibility of returning the money to its owner, havale kaman damarle, yuli biyadecha. It's as if he says to him, they should be in your hand. Hilkach. It's as if the Nigzal says to him, look, you hang on to it. It's a pikadon with you until it reaches my hand. And therefore, he doesn't have to return it. Hilkach. But therefore, Nishba, Abagav the Karmelay Yulu Bedecha, if he takes the Shvat checker denying it, even though the Nigzal is saying as if you keep it in hand until I reach you, came into Bayi Kapara, since there he took the Shvat checker and he has to attain Kapara, Losagi Adamati Liyade. Then the kapara cannot be attained until it reaches the hand of the party from whom he stole. Halo ishtaba. On the other hand, if he does not take a shvuah, have a gabe pikadon ad ati bishokule. It remains as a pikadon in the hands of the gazlan until the nigzal comes along and picks it up. So, in essence, what, as Rashi explains over here, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon argue whether he took a shvuah, whether he didn't take a shvuah. Their machloket is in both of those cases. That Rabbi Tarfon says you do not have to return it directly to the nigzal. And Rabbi Kiva says you do have to return it directly to the nigzal. But those are all cases where we don't know who the recipient party is. So Rabbi Kiva says you need to pay all parties. And Rabbi Tarfon says you only have to put it in the middle and let them work it out. In our case, here in the Mishnah, where we know exactly who he stole from, and he knows exactly who to return it to, and he's willing and admitted to the fact that he wants to return it. In the case of our Mishnah, both Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon will agree, because there all parties are known. And the only question is, does he need to attain kapara or not? When there's no shvuah, we leave it as an object being a pikadon with the gazlan until the nigzal comes and picks it up. And that everybody agrees you can do because of the known information here. So the nigzal knows where to come and pick it up. He knows how to get it. And that's, he's discharged his obligation of veshivat egzela because he admitted to the fact and he's ready to pay it back. And the nigzal will come and take it when he wants. The other hand, when he takes a shvuah, then there's an additional layer of kapara that is necessitated over there, which requires that he return it. Whether that's because the pasuk says, "Asher hu lo yitznano," or because of the necessity of the shvat sheker that generates a need for kapara, over there he has an additional obligation to ensure that it reaches the hands of the nigzal himself, and not enough that he says that it's a pikadon with me. Maybe it's also because of the fact that he's already denied it once and taken a shvat sheker that we don't even trust him to keep it as a pikadon, and the other party wants it back. That's according to Rashi, and the girsa that Rashi has here is, which is Ella Amarova. And we know anytime the Gemara says Ella, it rejects what it stated before, and this is a new answer. And so Rava is rejecting that it's according to Rabbi Kiva, rejecting it's according to Rabbi Tarfon, says it's Divrei HaKol. But the case of our Mishnah is different than the machloki between Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon. Our Mishnah, we know who the Nigzal is. In the case of Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon's argument, they don't know exactly who the Nigzal is. Then the hand Tosafot brings here, and he notes, the fi hasfarim de lo garsina and Ella. According to the Sfarim, there were numerous views within the Rishonim that the Gemara here does not have a Girsa of Ella, but rather Omarova. If that's the case, then Rova is continuing to answer the question the way that we have established it, which means that it's a Lo'olam Rabbi Tarfoni. The author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Tarfon, and therefore the case here is Behodeh Bifanav. And therefore, when he admits it, it's as if he says, Yehei Biyadcha Dami. It's as if he says it's in your hands. But then, if he takes a shvuah, then he has an additional obligation to return it. So what that says is that when Rabbi Tarfon says that you do not have to give it to each individual, just can place it down in between them, that's only in the case where he hasn't taken a shvuah. But if he takes a shvuah, there's an additional obligation of kapara. for all the reasons that we explained before, that he would have to return it to the person directly. But when he doesn't take a shvua and he's modeh, it's as if he's saying, I have it here, come and take it whenever you please. It's as if it's in your hand, come and take it whenever you want to pick it up, and he's discharged his obligation. Tosafot challenges that answer and says, maybe according to that, why couldn't Rabbi Akiva also be the author of our Mishnah? Because even though we said before that Rabbi Akiva is kones, the case where there was no shvua, but that's only in a case we don't know who the party is that the money is supposed to go to. But in our Mishnah, where we do know who the party is that the money is going to, who says there that he was kones? So Tosafot in the end has to say that minasvara, that's what you have to say, that the Gemara believed that Rabbi Akiva's knas, when a case where it wasn't a shvua, applies whether you know who the recipient nigzal is, or whether you don't know who the recipient nigzal is, and that's what prevented the Gemara from making Rabbi Akiva the author of our Mishnah. And therefore, according to Rabbi Akiva, until it gets to Beit Din, like Shtita Tosafot before, he has not done or exercised the obligation to return it, and that's why the Gemara couldn't set up the case like Rabbi Akiva. But according to, as the Tosafot points out, Rashi, that's not an issue because Elam Arava says that we are making the Mishnah like Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon. And Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon's Machloket is about a totally different case, separate from our Mishnah entirely. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Dalid Amud Aleph.